The History Show with Moz Duncan.
Good evening. On this week's program,
Craig expressed himself against the inclusion of the whole of Ulster in the Northern Parliament and thought six counties preferable. The reason given was that Protestant representation would be strengthened.
The creation of Northern Ireland, 100 years on. We'll discuss how best to mark an anniversary which is seen in very different ways by different communities.
I love talking to people and hearing their stories and hearing their backgrounds because they give you these other layers which also humanise things, and we move away from political histories being the only way of understanding the past.
Dr. Laura McAtackney and Dr. Eamon Phoenix will join me to talk about this complex and contested centenary. Also,
but if Eurovision's host country was falling apart, Europe was all loved up. And several of the 1990 contestants milked the political mood for all it was worth.
A look back at the 1990 Eurovision Song Contest and how the various entries reflected the changing political tides in Europe. But we begin this evening with Northern Ireland and the 100th anniversary of its creation. As we'll hear a little later, there are many specific dates on the calendar you could choose to mark this particular centenary. But first, we're going to look at a date and an event you may not know about. On the 5th of May 1921, a meeting took place between Éamon de Valera, president of Sinn Féin, and James Craig, the leader of the Ulster Unionist Party. It was the first and only time the two men met. It happened a few weeks before the 1921 Irish elections, which were explicitly fought on the issue of partition. Joining me now to talk about this historic meeting is historian Cormac Moore, author of the book Birth of the Border, The Impact of Partition in Ireland. Cormac, you're very welcome indeed to The History Show.
Thank you, Miles.
Tell us, first of all, how did this meeting ever come about?
Well, there had been talk about such a meeting in the months previous to the May meeting. Craig actually believed that there was actually a structures in place for them to meet formally. That was through the Council of Ireland under the Government of Ireland Act. He planned to lead the Northern delegation of 20 members, and he assumed that De Valera, you know, would make the Government of Ireland Act work and would lead the Southern Ireland members, and then they could talk about matters relevant to the island of Ireland. And De Valera said he actually was open to meeting with Craig as well. He essentially throughout 1921 changed his policy of on the North, where previously he had talked about coercing the North, but by 1921 he said he discounted the use of force and actually was even open to slightly abandoning the Republican idea by looking at an option of external association with a federalist system and an external association with the British Commonwealth. So there had been talks or rumours of that there would be talks between the two men, but it was Alfred Cope of Dublin Castle who actually arranged the meeting. And he seems to have tricked both of them into thinking the other had arranged or had wanted the meeting. But he was the main person who actually arranged the meeting.
It was all very cloak and dagger, the actual meeting itself. And we'll talk about that perhaps in a few minutes. But before the truce in July, so the truce is still actually a couple of months away, before the opening of the Northern Ireland Parliament in June, and indeed before the elections that took place later in May. So what did either leader have in mind? What were their objectives?
Craig did not want the election just to be about partition. So he was hopeful that he could get an agreement with De Valera that De Valera would accept the border and accept Northern Ireland, which was totally unrealistic. But that's what he wanted. Whereas De Valera wanted an agreement on Irish unity, which was also totally unrealistic. But it did show that both were willing to meet. It does kind of remove that perception that they were too dogmatic. Sinn Féin and Ulster Unionists could never talk to each other, would never meet. We know that's not true. Craig did meet with De Valera, and also Craig had two meetings with Collins and pacts with Collins in 1922. So that's not true. And I think, you know, that has to be put into perspective. You did make the point that it was extraordinary that it happened when it happened. Weeks before the Northern Ireland election, De Valera was still a wanted man. The British still wanted him. And he actually was arrested on the official opening of Parliament on June 22nd, although he was immediately released. So it was extraordinary that it happened. And it was very brave of Craig, actually, to and how it transpired, being driven by three IRA men, the three toughest looking men he'd ever seen, according to him, who were armed to their teeth. But yeah, it was extraordinary it happened when it did happen.
So tell us about the circumstances and the location of the meeting, and something about those three tough-looking IRA men, one of whom was Emmett Dalton, who was possibly one of the least tough-looking people you could meet in a day's walk. So what actually happened? I mean, it all seems very cloak and dagger and very clandestine, and perhaps even unnecessarily so.
Essentially, Greig came to Dublin on the pretext of meeting the Lord Lieutenant. So he arrived with his wife, Cecil, on the night before, the 4th of May, and stayed in the private lodge in Phoenix Park, which is now the US Embassy, Ambassador's residence. The next morning, he was driven from the Phoenix Park to Northumberland Road by Alfred Cope. He went to the house of the judge, James O'Connor. And actually, Father Michael O'Flanagan, prominent Sinn Féin priest, he was there in Northumberland Road. It was there that Emmett Dalton and Sean Harling, who was the courier of De Valera, and Joe Hyland, who was Collins' taxi man, or wheelman, as he was called. The three of them met Greig at Northumberland Road and then picked him up. I think Greig was exaggerating to a very large degree in saying they're the three toughest men he'd ever seen. Dalton with his debonair manner and, you know, toothbrush moustache certainly didn't fit that characterisation. But according to Dalton, he did threaten Greig in the car. He was sitting in the back seat. Hyland was driving. Harling was in the front seat, passenger side. And Dalton said, "Look, if we're stopped by Crown Forces, say you're my secretary. If you don't, you'll be the first to go." So they seemed to have changed cars as well. They took a roundabout route and they didn't want to tell Greig where he was. But actually, in Harling's witness statement, he said, Greig asked him, "Where are we now?" And he said, "We're in Clontarf." "Oh, this is where Brian Boru beat the Danes." And they actually stopped soon after in just on the Hoat Road on the Clontarf side, where De Valera was actually waiting for them. It's a house called Belvedere, owned by a Sinn Féin supporting solicitor, Joseph Green. And that's where De Valera met Greig.
And the two of them seem to have very different recollections of the meeting, right down to how long the meeting actually went on for.
I think they actually agreed. They both agreed it lasted for 90 minutes. Harling thinks it lasts for 30 minutes. Now, maybe Greig thought it felt like it lasted for 90 minutes because according to his view of the meeting, De Valera bored him to tears, harping on the grievances of 700 years. You know, by half an hour, he'd reached Brian Boru. By another half an hour, he'd reached the ear of some king a century or two later. By this time, I was getting tired. And I think it was actually the arrival of a Kerry Blue Terrier into the room that broke the deadlock. And Greig actually said, "Look, can we just write a statement and say we've met and leave it at that," essentially. But actually, De Valera said that Greig was being unfair in what he spoke about. He said he only spoke from a historical perspective on the Act of Union because Greig was claiming they had some moral duty to be bound by the Act, and he treated the Union as some mystical thing. And that's where Greig disagreed with him from an historical perspective.
And what was the significance, if any, of the meeting, other than the fact that a meeting did once take place between Eamon de Valera and James Greig?
Well, the British, if we look at the media accounts afterwards, it was definitely built up as a very significant moment that it would bring about peace in Ireland. It was a small step, I think, to bringing around negotiations between the British government and Sinn Féin. And Lord Derby from the cabinet, he had met de Valera a couple of weeks before that, and this was another step on that path. And actually, Collins, who had a lot more people on the inside within Dublin Castle, he actually realised that they thought this was an abandonment of sorts of the Republican ideal by Sinn Féin, and in some ways thwarted their negotiation stance. De Valera didn't agree with that, but that is what was felt within Dublin Castle, and Collins picked up on that. That was an admission of us giving up on something. Greig didn't have it all his own way when he went back home either. There were some very nervous unionists. Some believed the ludicrous rumours that Greig had gone to Dublin to ask De Valera to be Prime Minister of United Ireland, which was never on the cards. It was absolutely a ridiculous notion. But that's some of the jittery unionists did believe that. But there was genuine and real support within the unionist community for the meeting, particularly from traders and farmers who felt that that might stop the Belfast boycott, because they felt they were impacted on that at that stage.
Can you see this as part of the process that Andy Cope had instituted of legitimising De Valera in particular, but legitimising Sinn Féin to some extent, even though it was followed a few weeks later by the attack on the customs house?
Andy Cope, or his name is Alfred, but he's known as Andy, that was one of his strategies from day one when he joined Dublin Castle personnel in the spring, summer of 1920. He used to go down the drain as Nevin McCready, the British Commander-in-Chief in Ireland, used to say, and talk to Sinn Féin on a regular basis. And we know there was a lot of talks in late 1920 for a truce. So it was never a case that Lloyd George would never talk to Sinn Féin. He was always going to talk to Sinn Féin. What they had agreed, though, was that they would only do so once the Government of Ireland Act came into operation. This is a British government policy. So once the Act was passed in December 1920, they said, look, we're not going to talk to Sinn Féin for the period until it becomes operational. And the British military, optimistically, as it transpired, believed May was the best time to make the Act operational because the IRA would be routed at that stage. And then they could talk to Sinn Féin because the terms would be a lot more favourable for the British. So it was generally, the policy was going that way anyway. So I do think, you know, regardless of Cope's always consistent belief in talking to Sinn Féin, the British government were coming along to that strategy anyway before the meeting.
Well, my guest is Cormac Moore. His book is called Birth of the Border, The Impact of Partition in Ireland. It's published by Irish Academic Press. Cormac, many thanks for joining us on the History Show this evening.
Thanks, Miles.
Well, that meeting between De Valera and Craig took place at a crucial hinge point in Irish history. As we heard, the tete-a-tete between the two leaders, North and South, led to some media speculation on its significance and some hope that it might finally bring about peace on this island. Now, partition has been a fixed reality for about 100 years, and this has proved to be one of the most controversial centenaries on the commemorative calendar. To talk about this, I'm joined by two guests. Dr. Laura McAtackney is Associate Professor in the Department of Archaeology and Heritage Studies at Aarhus University in Denmark. And Dr. Eamon Phoenix is a political historian and a member of the Taoiseach's Expert Advisory Group on Centenaries. You're both very welcome to the History Show. Now, first of all, let's deal with the exact age of Northern Ireland, because it appears to have divided opinion. To designate the 100th anniversary, Boris Johnson's Centenary Historical Advisory Panel settled on the 3rd of May. That's the date in 1921 when the Government of Ireland Act came into effect, the legislation that partitioned Ireland into two self-governing polities. Eamon, though, there are actually a number of other dates that you could make a case for when it comes to marking the creation of Northern Ireland, aren't there?
Absolutely, Miles. There are at least four or five dates. I mean, you could go for the 23rd of December 1920, when the Government of Ireland Act, the Partition Act, became law. You could go for the 22nd of June 1921, when King George V opened the new Northern Ireland Parliament in state, triggering the new state's existence, you could say. You could go for the date of the treaty in December 1921. You could go for the date the North opted out of the Free State, into which it had been included under the treaty, which would be the 7th of December 1922, or you could go for the 3rd of December 1925, when the tripartite agreement confirmed the 1920 border between the three governments. So there you are.
And Laura, I mean, when we speak about specific dates, obviously there's a lot of fluidity there. You said that earmarking a day as the centenary of the creation of Northern Ireland is an odd but understandable endeavour, but it clearly can't be reduced to a fixed point, can it?
No, but I think that's the thing with commemorations. They're not really about what exactly happened in history. They're how we want to remember it in the present. So it doesn't make sense to commemorate something, as Eamon said, over a number of years, because that lessens it as well, because it doesn't give a fixivity to it and it doesn't give an inevitability to it as well. So that's why, you know, a point in the diary is picked, but that doesn't make any sense to historians who really want to engage with the processes of how these things happen rather than, you know, picking one point whenever it became real.
Eamon, if we look back on how the Republic, of Ireland commemorated, say, the 50th anniversary of the Easter Rising versus the 100th anniversary, they were very different commemorations, weren't they?
Very different. And of course, the second anniversary was conditioned by the troubles which had been raging in the North for, you know, by that stage, I suppose, about 16 years, perhaps more. And you can also make the comparison between how the Northern Ireland government celebrated the birth of Northern Ireland in 1971. I mean, there was a kind of a fanfare, and you had a sort of a public celebration called Ulster 71 with the rather jarring jingle at the time, Ulster 71, come and join in the fun, because it coincided with, you know, internment, blood on the streets, the Ballymurphy massacre we've heard about in recent days and all of that, and of course was boycotted by the nationalist population at that time. This year has been much more muted because I think people are aware of the complexity, really, of these events. That, you know, it was a period which was much contested at the time, which was surrounded by violence in Ireland, North and South, and left a legacy which, you know, began to haunt that government right down to the 1960s until it actually fell in 1972.
It was also, Eamon, a time when I think unionists were getting something like 2/3 of the vote in Northern Ireland elections. So that alone makes the current situation very different, doesn't it?
It does indeed. I mean, this is a time when Carson said that James Craig, the Prime Minister designate of the new state, and Carson as the unionist leader, went into the matter of demographics. Carson put it almost parish by parish and townland by townland. And the question was, would the old nine-county province, which was the Ulster of the Covenant, be the acreage for the new Northern Ireland state when partition came into effect? The Long Committee under Walter Long, a British politician, which drew up the plans for two Irish parliaments and so on, they favoured a nine-county province because you would have a 43-44% Catholic and therefore nationalist minority at that time. In fact, religion and politics did very much coincide at that time. But Craig rejected it, and we actually have his intervention recorded on the 13th of November 1919. He was interviewed by a minister, H.A.L. Fisher, the Minister of Education from the Long Committee, and he recorded Craig expressed himself against the inclusion of the whole of Ulster in the Northern Parliament and thought six counties preferable. The reason given was that Protestant representation would be strengthened. So you have this sectarian headcount really at the heart really of the creation of the new state on the part of the unionists, and they of course have an overweening influence within the conservatives who really control that coalition. Now, things have changed a lot since 1921. I suppose the minority, as it was known down to fairly recent years, sat at about 33% in 1921 when the first election confirmed a 2/3 unionist majority, a 1/3 nationalist and Sinn Féin minority. By the 1950s, the Catholic minority, because of emigration from the region, had sat around perhaps 35%. But with the troubles, with Thatcherite economics in Britain, people were not moving. The Catholic population began to grow. You now had fair employment under the law, and the result is the Catholic population is probably this year, as the census just taken will reveal, overtaking the Protestant population. Now, that doesn't mean you have a nationalist majority, because things are more complex than they were in 1921. But certainly, people from a perceived nationalist background are now actually a majority. And this, of course, is incredible in a state that was set up to protect the Protestant minority in the north of Ireland 100 years ago.
Laura, during the Troubles, commemorations, north and south, were toned down, weren't they? Or skewed, at least, because of the conflict.
Yes, there was definitely an uncomfortableness about remembering the background to the state's formation, particularly the violence associated with it during the Troubles, and a great discomfort, you know, particularly in the south. I worked in Kilmainham Jail for a number of years doing a graffiti recording project, and I talked a lot to the director about just how uncomfortable people felt in the 80s and 90s that this icon of, you know, of the initial formation of the state was associated with remembering republicanism, and how there was actually attempts even to cover graffiti over at the time because people were just so uncomfortable with what was happening in the north. But often skewing that, because as we know, the Troubles was very complicated. There was a lot of events happened that sometimes were a reaction to others, sometimes were parallel. It was a long process of, you know, a dirty war and a very difficult conflict. But at times that was communicated differently in the north and the south. Against also in England and Scotland have very different memories of what the Troubles was.
Laura, you grew up in Belfast, but you've been based for a number of years in Aarhus in Denmark. When you reflect on or when you study Northern history, do you have a distance now? Does it give you a different perspective?
Yes, it's actually something I'm increasingly writing about in my work, because I do work a lot with heritage and memory as well as history. So it's as much to do with how we create our understandings of the past and actually, you know, what we retrieve from documents and what we retrieve from people's insights. And so, as I say, I grew up in Belfast during the Troubles, and I came from a working class background. My family come from West Belfast. So, like, you know, my dad grew up in the White Rock. He knew people who died in Ballymurphy. And so, you know, we have these stories that have, you know, clung on for a long time, often quite silenced. But I find it really interesting. I started studying materializations of segregation about 10 years ago, particularly peace walls and particularly planning, and how it's, you know, it created and maintained the conflict for a long time, and how into a peace process, it's hard to get away from that whenever you've planned separation into the city. But I only found out from speaking to my mum that actually my grandparents' house that was going to become my parents' house was a peace wall now in East Belfast. So my family came from East Belfast originally and moved to the west, and we just have no connection there anymore because the house was firebombed. It was taken over by the city council and became a peace wall in 1972. So you can't really ignore that when that's your family background as well, that, you know, the fractures of memory are actually about place being fractured and about people having so many different memories of the past that just don't get passed down, or get passed down in very particular ways.
Eamon, you're a huge advocate, I know, of public history. How important do you think that is when it comes to divisive centenaries such as partition and the creation of Northern Ireland, or potentially divisive centenaries at least?
Well, I think public history, Miles, is certainly very, very important in a place like Northern Ireland today, where so many people haven't had the opportunity, even at a very general level, to study Irish history. I mean, I worked in lifelong learning as well as teaching history in university, and I would have had very, very privileged people in my groups who were, you know, studying 1916 partition. And they would inevitably say to you, these doctors and lawyers at the end of the day, you know, we never studied Irish history at school. Many of them were from a perceived unionist background. And I think there is that deficit there. And I think one thing very, very fortunately happened about 10 years ago as we faced into the decade of centenaries in the north. And that was that the executive at the time set up a committee of ministers to deal with this. And they fell out almost immediately. There was talk about a 21-gun salute at Stormont to mark the birth of Northern Ireland, baby boxes for children born this year. And you could see this was going to replicate the worst aspects of Ulster 71. So the upshot was a group of people at arm's length from government, the Community Relations Council, Heritage Lottery, historians, including myself, librarians, museum people, and important people from the community sector on places like the Falls and the Shankill got together and thought, you know, this is too important to leave to a fractured executive at Stormont. We better do something about this. And we actually began to meet as the Round Table and Smokeville Rooms came up with a sort of a set of principles, which are now almost set in stone and accepted like the Ten Commandments by ministers and indeed councils throughout the north. And basically we said, look, we have to stick to the facts. We have to reflect different narratives. We have to look at the consequences. And of course, if an exhibition is to seek funding in a nationalist area or a unionist area, it must travel. It must be able to travel across that divide, the peace line, to the other side. Now, that has worked very well. Projects have attracted funding from Europe, Peace Four, from the Taoiseach's Department, the Community Relations Council in the North, and we've had all sorts of initiatives. And it means that somebody like me, for example, I have spoken in East Belfast at the height of the flag protest. I remember saying to my wife that night, I'm taking your car, darling, because I had committed myself months before to go and speak about, really, it was amazing, from Patrick Pearce on the Newtonards Road to the UVF man at the Easter Rising. Both true. Pearce, as a Gael Gore, visited a national school in East Belfast where Irish was taught, and a UVF man from East Belfast went to Dublin to join the British Army and was trapped in the Gresham Hotel during the Rising and kept an incredible diary. Now, I actually went and gave that talk and the place was packed. And, you know, that's the experience right across the board. A lot of people of a certain age are engaging with history. It's easier when you're more concerned to find somebody who will take you across the road by the hand rather than question your politics or religion. But also, I mean, I think we've had intergenerational events involving A-level students studying history pre-university with ordinary people. We had a conference in Benburb before the lockdown last year. And a lot of things are being done on the ground. And I find, for example, I'm very interested in political misfits. And I went to a village in County Antrim, Kilead, number of years back. Well, the most famous person to emerge from that area was the Reverend James Hamilton Irwin, a Presbyterian minister, a friend of De Valera, who toured America with Dev in 1920 in support of an Irish Republic and had to face the music when he got home. In fact, he was sentenced to 2 years imprisonment, although he was released fairly early on because of the protests from Canadian Presbyterians about this. Now, I mean, when I went there, everybody wanted to talk about their former pastor, even though they were on a different page to him politically. And it was amazing. He was the most important person that had ever gone to Kilkenny, and there were rumours that Dev had hidden there during his return to Ireland as the War of Independence continued. In other words, you're looking for the quirky. You're looking at things like that. And I think a lot of very valuable work has been done on the ground in terms of public history.
Laura, what about your own thoughts on the discipline of history itself and how it's utilised in these big public history events?
Yeah, like I have to say, I've got a lot of respect for public history. I think it does a lot of really good work. There's a lot. I think, you know, history is so complicated, actually. Whenever people are told it, they have a greater understanding of their own side, but also the other side. There's nothing to be lost by actually talking about what happened in the past. And I think sometimes that fear of we don't want to upset one side or seem like we're overbalancing actually stops us talking about things that everybody find interesting and everybody can find something in. It's like one of my issues, though, is more with some of the academic histories, which can be quite distant and abstract from that, where, you know, they don't always engage with the issues of working with archives in a state, you know, which is essentially still got colonial legacies, which the papers are reflecting power structures, which are governing in ways that don't always understand what they're even governing. Like my PhD was on the Mays prison, and I had been an archivist in the public record office. So I had a really good idea of what the files look like. I actually, one of my jobs was to review files from government departments. And it was just really clear to me that you have to be so critical how you work with that stuff. Like there's really interesting information. A lot of the marginalia is the most important things you'll find. It's people contradicting each other, having arguments between departments. But you have to be really aware how you're working with that material. And actually, it's one of the main reasons I went into studying material culture, studying peace walls, studying prisons, studying prison artifacts, because they just tell us slightly different things. I love talking to people and hearing their stories and hearing their backgrounds, because they give you these other layers, which also humanise things. And we move away from political histories being the only way of understanding the past.
Eamon, when it comes to recording memories, there's important and interesting work I know being done by community groups. Tell us something about, for example, the Oral History Project in County Fermanagh.
Yes, this has been launched recently by Fermanagh Rural District Council, and it's looking back 100 years at the impact of partition on Fermanagh, Cavan, Leitrim, that kind of part of southwest Ulster, kind of North Connacht. And it's amazing because when you look back to that period, nobody talked about Fermanagh and Tyrone, which is a sort of a rolls off the tongue before 1914 and the Buckingham Palace Conference. They talked about Fermanagh and Monaghan. That was the legal area. That was the jurisdiction. Most of large parts of North Leitrim and Cavan were actually governed by the Poor Law Union in Enniskillen, and people drifted in that direction. There was a very active railway, the Sligo, Leitrim and Northern Counties, which hardwired the west of Ireland. Linen connected the west of Ireland at that time. And then as a hard border began to assert itself on the very eve of the Irish Civil War, and both wings of the IRA were muscling in on the Fermanagh border, Beleek and Pettigo were captured. Pettigo was a divided village, mostly in Donegal, some in Fermanagh. Churchill sent in the artillery in June 1922, howitzer guns. And I'm working with Northern Ireland Screen, and we have been using actually footage from that period, Pathé newsreels with audiences. So I will sort of talk, I will voice over a series of clips right through that period, as much as we can get, say, on the border in that area or any other aspect. And people, this is jogs people's memories, because they hear ancestral voices around the fireside in the 60s or the 40s that talked about what happened then, talked about the Drumully salient in County Monaghan that was more or less cut off from the rest of its Free State hinterland and could only be accessed from the north. Or they remember a school in County Fermanagh discovered about 1928, which had only had students from Donegal from partition, because it was just over the hedge, I mean, from Donegal. And it only had Donegal students. It was being financed by the Northern Ireland government. And eventually, when they discovered this and sent an inspector out finally after the border was firmed up, they closed it down. But these are great stories, the stories of smuggling right down to modern times. And people find, as they do in West Belfast, Laura's talking there about, you know, the evictions in East Belfast in the 1920s and all of that. You sometimes find that the Peace Wall today is where a British Army machine gun nest was in 1921, when you had the same kind of internecine violence. And you find this in the border as well. And just last night I was talking to a group across the Glens in County Leitrim, and they had brought together local kind of historical societies from Leitrim, Fermanagh, Monaghan and Tyrone. And people were focused on the impact of partition on minorities, why Fermanagh in the 1926 census had more people from Southern Ireland of a Protestant background than any other county in the north, as people perhaps feeling pressure, intimidation from an Orange Unionist background migrated northwards after those violent years 1920 to 1922. So there's so much worth recording, even at the remove of a century.
And I know that you, Eamon, have worked with community groups and that you have brought them down to Dublin from Northern Ireland to visit places like the former employer of Laura, Kilmainham Jail, Dublin Castle and places like that. What's their response been?
Oh, tremendous. I mean, this is one thing the Taoiseach's department over the last 10 years has facilitated, bringing groups down, cross-community and what we call up here single identity groups, maybe from the Shankill Road or from Portadown, who are maybe, you know, putting their toe in the water of the Republic for the first time. And I always remember a young girl, she was about 25, getting on a bus in East Belfast that I was taking down to Kilmainham at Dublin Castle and then Arbour Hill on the one day. And she said, "Do you think we'll be attacked?" This was 10 years ago. I said, "Are you a banker?" She said, "No." I said, "Then you're absolutely safe," as the bus swept southwards. But the key thing is that everybody suddenly, what people discover if they come from a unionist background or even a nationalist background and they go to Dublin Castle and they see the portraits of the kings and queens and they see Victoria's throne and they're aware of the centrality of the castle as the vortex of British power in Ireland, the whole of Ireland, down to 1922. It has an amazing effect. And they say, and they kept all these things here. They kept George III's portrait and they kept Victoria's throne. They didn't dump it, you know, with British rule in 1922. And that amazes many people. And I found that's tremendous. I've also found it's very, very worthwhile to bring groups from a unionist, loyalist background north of the border to places like Clonus and Cavan, where they meet cross-community groups very much involved in industrial development, urban investment or local history, where they come from different backgrounds before 1922. People from an Orange Unionist tradition, people who would have had ancestors in the IRA in that period. And they're working together now in these areas. And that's tremendously as well. And we brought a group from Portadown down to Castle Saunderson, which, as you probably know, is on the Clonus Cavan Concession Road. And the gates are in the north of Castle Saunderson, the driveways in the south, and the great castle where Colonel Edward Saunderson, the founder of Ulster Unionism, lived until his death in 1906. And of course, he was the MP for North Armagh, the Grand Master of the Orange Order, the Unionist MP. It was only an hour on the train from Portadown to Belturbet. And people are suddenly amazed. He's just buried 20 yards on the wrong side of the border.
I've actually seen Saunderson's template for the border, which coincidentally carves out all of his estate and puts it into Northern Ireland. Laura, you know, you've grew up in Belfast. Up to the present day, do you find different histories? Do you come across different ideas? You know, ideas that you can categorically say are erroneous ideas, or, I mean, to use the more modern phrase, alternative facts.
Yes, so definitely. And I think actually it's one of the useful things about sitting on social media that a lot of us as academics kind of, you know, berate ourselves for sitting on Twitter and things like that, because, you know, we should be working and writing papers rather than communicating. But one of the things you find is actually there's quite a lot of fake histories, and you can always understand the logic behind them, but they also don't, you know, actually have any basis in fact. So I remember growing up in North Belfast and, you know, living in an area that was kind of, you know, lower middle class, and it was mixed, and having a lot of my Protestant friends who didn't realise the partition was actually only less than 100 years old at that stage. They thought it was, you know, no, it's always been there. I don't know what you're talking about. There's always been a border. But also even I've had long discussions on Twitter, which is a very hard thing to do when you've only got a certain number of characters, about how that after partition, Ulster didn't become six counties. Ulster was still a nine-county province, and that the state of Northern Ireland is not the same as the province of Ulster. But absolutely would not accept this. Quite a few times I've had these discussions, and you're like, no, there was no change to the province. The state is different. You know, and I think it's because of, you know, parties with Ulster in the title. There was just an absolute, lack of ability to get why they would use Ulster if Ulster also included three other counties that weren't in Northern Ireland. So it's actually quite easy for these things to perpetuate. You know, one of the things I study a lot alongside peace walls is the memorialisation of the troubles that has happened alongside it. And it's often presenting very skewed histories and very one-sided histories for both sides about their past that completely doesn't engage with what's happening across the wall. So people who have very similar experiences that only live, you know, a matter of metres apart will just have very different ideas about what happened in the past. And some of them are slightly skewed, some of them are completely wrong. And I think that's why those conversations are really important, particularly public history, bringing people together.
Can I ask you both about the context of Brexit, which, you know, we're now approaching the fifth anniversary of Brexit, coinciding with the 100th anniversary of partition. Eamon, as far as you're concerned, how has Brexit skewed the commemoration that will be taking place, should be taking place, for the centenary of the creation of the State of Northern Ireland?
Oh, I think, well, Brexit, of course, has sharpened identity on both sides of the community, very much so. And this was a region, Northern Ireland, which voted 56% to stay in the EU. And that was a view shared by many, many middle-class Protestants in business and the professions as well, and, you know, whose children had benefited from the Erasmus programme. On the other hand, you find inner city loyalist groups, you know, who have not gained very much of the peace dividend from the Troubles, who are into fourth generation unemployment in areas like East Belfast, which the executive, you know, whether orange or green, has more or less forgotten and passed by. And these groups, I think, felt, and I think some other political representatives felt, that Brexit would create a new Iron Curtain type border, you know, across the island of Ireland. And this would be a very, very good thing. But of course, it's worked out disastrously from the border and the Irish Sea and all the rest of it. And even firms in places like Kilkeel and South Down are now sending their fish to Ross Lair to get them directly to the continent and avoid all the red tape. So you can see the gravitational pull towards the south and the EU within, 3 months of Brexit actually becoming operative. Now, certainly, you know, I find that this has caused great confusion among people, especially at the margins, you know. And it's also began this sort of question about how sort of valued is Ulster unionism by the British establishment and the Conservative Party. There's this gulf between the conservatism and indeed the unionism of Boris Johnson and the unionism of the DUP, for example. And the loyalists would find them even more on the flank of all of that. And I think you could see how this crisis has bled out in the British government's response to the centenary of Northern Ireland. Initially, Boris Johnson announced a forum which would sort of bring in all interested groups. And he talked about celebrating. Now, this sent alarm bells ringing for people like me right away. You can't celebrate the events of 100 years ago unless you're going to celebrate the McMahon murderers and the Altneve massacre, one of a Catholic family by the police, one of a Protestant community by the IRA. Unless you're going to remember that as something worth celebrating, you're into real trouble in this whole period. And therefore, I think he set up an advisory group of historians. They didn't manage to attract anybody identifiably from a nationalist background at all, because people were turned off by this idea of celebration. And then they obviously then retreated from that, and they kept a very low profile and seemed fearful to do anything. And therefore, very little has actually happened. And what they have actually done is they've endorsed all the public history that we've all been involved in for so long, mediated through the councils and heritage lottery, where money is provided according to certain acceptable criteria which respect difference. And I think that's where we are. So, I mean, that gulf between the Tory government of today and unionism, it's always been there. And coming back to a point that Laura made earlier about Ulster, you know, we had the North of Ireland cricket ground on the Ormer Road because a lot of the cricket was played in Donegal, and that goes back to a pre-partition stance. But in fact, in 1948, after the Republic of Ireland was declared, Lord Brookborough, the Unionist Prime Minister, asked the British Labour government to allow him to rename the North as Ulster. In other words, there'd be no confusion between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. This would be Ulster. And after some consideration by officials, Attlee, Major Attlee, the Prime Minister, came back and said, no, you can't, because it's not Ulster.
Laura, did you see Brexit as, you know, a 95th anniversary, if you like, reaffirmation of partition?
Yeah, like Brexit's just been, you know, a huge issue in terms of commemoration, because also, as we've talked about already, partition is not an event, but also it's part of a decade of commemoration. And in the middle of it, at a time when there was still kind of faltering ideas about how do we do this in a more assured way, for Brexit to have happened just completely exploded any possibility of doing assured commemorative events. You know, there's no problems with commemorating the past, even when it's very difficult. And indeed, it's probably a better thing to actually be re-engaging with what that past meant. But you can't have a celebratory tone. And that's the problem with it, as, you know, Eamon has already noted, that the terms, the uses of celebration, the lack of nuance from Westminster about actually what was going on, completely turned off, you know, nationalists, and it's particularly the berating of nationalists for not wanting to be involved. You know, the kind of assuming that if nationalists didn't want to celebrate or commemorate partition, that that was, you know, a bad thing on their part and bad faith, when actually they were being asked to commemorate something that was not a positive event for them. Particularly when we have this at the same time as Ballymurphy inquest was going on in the background, with these, you know, really huge injustices that hadn't been dealt with by the state. It's just too much to ask people to want to be involved in the celebration of something that they didn't see as celebratory. And I think just the mechanisms around Brexit, the attempts for the DUP to push it through against what was, you know, wanted by the majority of the population, has just created a very negative tone since 2016 in terms of how we remember the formation of the state at all.
Well, thank you very much, both of you, for sharing your thoughts on a very complex and contested centenary commemoration. My guests are Dr. Laura McAtackney and Dr. Eamon Phoenix. Thank you both very much indeed for joining us this evening on The History Show.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
After the break, we'll be looking back at Eurovision 1990. Stay with us.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
Well, this Tuesday, Ireland's Eurovision hopeful, Leslie Roy, will be competing in the semi-final of the 2021 Eurovision Song Contest with her song Maps. The event will be the 65th edition of the long-running song competition. We're going to look back now to 1990 and the 35th edition of the contest, the only time it was hosted by the Socialist Federal Republic of Yugoslavia. In this piece, Martina Relihan explains how that particular contest reflected the changing political tides in Europe.
With Rock Me Baby, the Yugoslavian band Riva warbled their way to Eurovision's Song Contest victory in 1989. It was the first win for Yugoslavia, the only communist country in the contest, which had been competing since 1961. And it was nearly too late. In November 1989, the Berlin Wall fell, harbinger of the end of the post-war order in Europe and the implosion of Yugoslavia in the 1990s. Croatia's capital, Zagreb, played host to the 35th Eurovision in 1990, by which time Rock Me Baby sounded like the swan song of the Socialist Federal Republic of Yugoslavia. Croatia's loyalty to the Yugoslav Federation was shaky. 2 weeks before the contest, its nationalist HDZ party, under the leadership of Franjo Tudjman, won the country's first multi-party elections. This marked the end of the Yugoslav Communist Party's monopoly on power and paved the way for Croatia's declaration of independence in 1991. But if Eurovision's host country was falling apart, Europe was all loved up. The European Community, as it was called then, was on the way to further integration through the EU's single market, while the unification of Germany was only a few months away. And several of the 1990 contestants milked the political mood for all it was worth. Norway presented the Brandenburg Gate. but it flopped, finishing last. Austria's variation on a theme, No More Walls, fared better. And Germany's Free to Live finished ninth. All three were seriously outdone by Ireland's masterclass in Eurovision Song Contest diplomacy somewhere in Europe. The song, delivered by the late Liam Riley, seated at the piano in his moss green jacket and tie, was all things to all Europeans, and it went down a treat with the juries, finishing a close second. I remember Amsterdam as we sail on the canal, and as the leaves began to fall, we were walking in old Brussels. The night belonged to Italy, however, and their white-suited singer Toto, with the song NCMA Together 1992, the date a reference to the forthcoming Maastricht Treaty, which ushered in the European Union. NCMA, unite, unite Europe. Even if your Italian wasn't up to translating lyrics such as Europe is not far away, this is Italian song for you, we are more and more free, our stars, one single flag, stronger and stronger. Toto belted home the core message in the plainest of English. Arms stretched wide, eyes closed, and with hands clasped together for a final soulful Europe. Unite, unite, Europe. During the voting, which delivered Italy its victory, the role of token Eurosceptic was happily assumed by the irrepressible Terry Wogan, commentating for the BBC.
Well, I have to tell you, I didn't give that Italian song a prayer. Not a prayer.
And what about the song from Yugoslavia, the politically compromised hosts? Staying as far away from lofty sentiments as it was possible to get, they opted for the pop song Hajde Duludujemo or Let's Go Crazy. Let him fall in love with my eyes. Your lips are like chocolate. That's what I like. Yugoslavia competed as a full federation for the last time in Eurovision in Rome the following year. Their entry, Brazil, giving Europe a particularly wide berth. It was sung by the hapless Baby Doll and finished second last, scoring a mere 1 point. And so Yugoslavia's involvement in Eurovision petered out in a tuneless la-la-la and cha-cha-cha. The winner was Carola with Captured by a Love Storm, wind machine going at full tilt. She served some honest-to-God Swedish pop, signalling that Europe's bout of self-indulgence in Eurovision was at an end. Free to sing, like angels from above. I am captured by a love song. Captured by a love song. Give me a prayer. Captured by a love song.
That was Martina Relihan there with some reflections on the 1990 Eurovision Song Contest. That's all we've time for on this evening's programme, and indeed all we've time for on this season of The History Show. This will be our last episode for a while, but we'll be back in the autumn with another run of the series. In the meantime, details of all our items as well as podcasts are available on our website, rte.ie/historyshow. Our researcher is Liz Gillis. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. For now, from me, Miles Dungan, and producer Lorcan Clancy, goodbye and thanks for listening.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.